Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. If you drive directly west from Milwaukee for about 3.5 hours, you'll come to the city of Prairie du Chien, one of Wisconsin's oldest cities. Given its age and history, it's no surprise that Prairie du Chien has some interesting connections to the American Civil War. This Saturday, the Prairie du Chien Historical Society will open a new permanent exhibit at the Fort Crawford Museum about the Swift U.S. Army General Hospital. It was one of only three hospitals in Wisconsin to care for wounded Civil War soldiers. This new exhibit, replete with hospital history and Civil War-era music, is a perfect example of one of Wisconsin's little-known connections to the war between the states. Of course, there's one Wisconsin connection to the Civil War that needs little introduction if you know your history. The famous Iron Brigade inspired respect and fear in both their comrades and enemies alike. Also known as the Black Hat Brigade, they gained a reputation for not only their wardrobe, but also for their courage and tough fighting style during some of the war's biggest battles. And the brigade boasted not one, but three Wisconsin regiments. As part of our Iron Brigade and Beyond, Wisconsin in the Civil War series, we turn now to Civil War historian Thomas Martin Sobotky for a look at this brave brigade.
The Iron Brigade wasn't formed right away. The first regiment that actually got out east to Washington, there are other regiments that are forming up in the west to go and fight in Tennessee, later Kentucky, you know, whatever. But the 2nd Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry was trained at Camp Randall, 1,100 men in April of 1861 go, I don't want to say joyously, but it was exciting because they're all going out to this great adventure and they're serving the Union cause and they're very, very committed to it. And they have some very good officers. They get to Washington and do some drilling with McDowell's army, and they go out, and they're the only regiment in the brigade that fights at First Bull Run. And this does lead to the first kind of interior controversy within the brigade, because when the other regiments are formed up with the 2nd Wisconsin, the Union generals wanted to have an all-Western brigade. And there was the 3rd and 5th Wisconsin that followed, but they went to other brigades with Eastern regiments in them. And one of the things we have to understand is that most of the soldiers that fought in the Civil War, there were regulars, but most of them were volunteers from their home state. And they would have, you know, like the 44th New York or the 57th Pennsylvania or something like that. And there's a lot of state pride involved. And so they wanted to have this Western regiment. And when the other regiments came out that would be attached to the brigade, that was the 6th Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry, the 7th Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry, and a bunch of wild Hoosiers from Indiana, the 19th Indiana. And they were all really much like their Wisconsin brothers. There wasn't a whole lot of difference. They were Westerners too. Even Indiana was considered out west, and maybe they even had more of a struggle trying to be seen as civilized or something. I don't know. But the thing was that the 2nd Wisconsin, when they met up with their new brothers in this new brigade, they constantly traded on the fact that, look, we have seen the elephant, which in the Civil War meant that you had been in a real battle where, unfortunately, you saw people killed in horrible carnage. And you'd come through it like a man and you'd survived it. And that was a badge of honor. And the 2nd constantly traded on that, and these new regiments in the brigade, mostly from Wisconsin also, couldn't say that. And it bugged them. But they looked at the militia uniforms. These are gray wool uniforms, just like the ones they have. But since the 2nd Wisconsin had been in the Army several months longer, they were falling apart and getting frayed at the edges, and the men's breeches had big holes in them. So they dubbed the 2nd the Raggedy-Ass 2nd. And so that was their way of kind of getting back at them. The brigade got a new commander, or a commander. He was Major John Gibbon, who had commanded Battery B, 4th U.S. Artillery, a regular artillery battery. They'd come in from Utah, where they'd been fighting the Mormons and Indians, and he had a lot of experience. He was a West Pointer. He was from the Carolinas. He originally actually was a Northerner. The family, his father had a government job, but he really grew up in North Carolina. So it was assumed by all his friends and family that he would join the Confederate Army and resign his commission. He did not. So he was already paying big time for his decision to remain loyal to the Union. He was a West Pointer, of course, and that had a lot to do with it. He had taken an oath. Some Southerners actually stayed loyal to the Union. All of them had it really bad from both sides. On the one hand, people in the South see them as traitors to the Confederate cause. And Northerners sometimes see a guy like Gibbon and say, well, is he really loyal? When the pinch comes, is he really going to do what's necessary? Because, you know, he's a Southerner. And those are questions that he faced. But Gibbon had a gift. He understood the difference between regular soldiers, which he had commanded out west, and the nature of a volunteer. Because volunteers really had to have it drummed into them to obey higher officers and orders. And it's a real problem when you're trying to pull together a group of volunteers. The second was a little ahead of the game. But as a brigade, they were very unruly. Gibbon, on the one hand, gave them a little more rope to hang themselves with at times, but was very tough on everything related to drill. And it was his thinking that when they got into a real tough fight, that would be needed, that they did not yet understand that. Really, they got a lot of training in the winter and spring of 1862. And I want to relate something that happened that's kind of interesting. Gibbon was really disliked thoroughly by the whole brigade in the first few months. It's almost like every military movie you've seen where, you know, the unit has to come together. There's something to that. And he had went and got from Army stores around Washington, D.C., he had found a bunch of old regular U.S. Army fancy uniforms, long woolen blue, dark blue frock coats, fancy belts, and to top it off, these hardy hats, which are like Stetsons or slouch hats, which can be flipped up on one side very jauntily, and a lot of the men could put a little feather cockade in the cap, and it's really cool. And of course, his idea was this will set his brigade apart from the entire army because no one else was wearing those hats, these big black hats. The kepi, those little Civil War caps that kids get at battlefields in summers with their families, that's what you're used to seeing. And these guys have a whole different look to them. And that was for esprit de corps. And it worked out that way as these men came to be known within the Army. But they also were given white gaiters, which I think assists soldiers in when they're going through underbrush and advancing, not getting caught up on briars. But these are white, and you have to lace them and put belt buckles on them, and they're a pain to keep white for inspection, and the men hated them. And one morning, Gibbon came out of his tent to start the day with an orderly, and there next to his tent was his horse, wearing gaiters. And he was just completely incensed. And I think the brigade enjoyed that because that was still in a phase where they were in training and they were still learning. And in the 1890s, he came back to Wisconsin for a brigade reunion. And he was still an active general in the United States Army. But he got off a train and came in and joined them for the evening. And one of his first questions was, okay, now you guys can finally tell me who put the gaiters on my horse back in 1862? Nobody would tell. So the men were very sobered by Bronner Farm, but 2 days later they fight at Second Bull Run honorably. They march up to South Mountain, and on September 14th they fight a third fight. That's very tough, and then they're at Antietam in a fourth fight. So they get into four major actions between August 28th and September 17th of 1862. Hardly any unit in the Army was that bloody in that short amount of time, and nowhere did they run away or not stand their ground.
For
Pewaukee writer, teacher, and independent Civil War historian Thomas Martin Sabotke is the author of the book Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory, published by Moving Train Books, LLC. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce produces our series, Iron Brigade and Beyond, Wisconsin in the Civil War. We'll hear another installment later this month. You can hear all of our Civil War segments from our series link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect.